jam. Got me running round in circles, grinning upside down. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NavaZoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NABA Zoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And first off, before we introduce the speaker, I want to thank Katie O. for suggesting to Molly B. that she perform this service tonight. And Katie, are you there?
I am. I'm driving.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, did you want to say a word or two and for a little introduction for Molly B? Can you do that while you're driving?
Yeah, sure.
Great.
I can. Yeah, so I have the privilege of sponsoring Molly. I think we started working together, I want to say about 3 years ago. And, man, if I could, I'd have 5 sponsees just like her. She's super willing to take any and all suggestions. May not always like them, but is willing to take them. And, I mean, it's just evident in the growth that she's had even through difficult times. She stays engaged in this process. So you guys are in for a treat. Love you, girl.
Okay, Molly, take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Katie. Thanks, everyone. And thanks, Tim, for asking me. I am Molly Berger, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 10th, 2015. I am part of a home group, which is the Keystone Group in Buford. We're at the Church on the Hill. We meet Wednesdays and Fridays at 8 p.m. Wednesday we have a big book study, and Friday we have a speaker meeting. So if you're in Buford, we'd love to have you come on by. I do have a sponsor. She has a sponsor. I do sponsor other women, and I'm available to sponsor other women. And so I'm supposed to say what it was like before I, you know, picked up my white chip, what happened, and what it's like now. And I can kind of give you the reader's version of it, which is I never felt comfortable in my own skin. I always felt different and bad. I never wanted to be who or where I was in that moment. I was too afraid to let myself be truly seen and known ever. And that kind of led to me being restless and irritable. I was stuck always in between please see me and help me, and I'm okay, I got this, I don't need your help. And I was always stuck there. Eventually that led to drinking, which was my solution at the time, because that allowed me to fit in, it quieted that inner voice, and it eased that inner struggle for me. That drinking eventually led to consequences. I would lie and I just became someone that I was embarrassed to be and that I never thought that I would be. And when I felt that way, it brought me right on back to feeling different and bad. And it was just this huge cycle that went round and round and round. And it wasn't until I got to AA that I learned that if I inserted God or my higher power in between feeling different and bad before I became restless and irritable, then I could stop that cycle. But, you know, before I did that, I couldn't even consider not drinking. It was my only solution. And so basically, in a nutshell, AA just, it taught me how to insert God into my life. And that's kind of like the, like I said, the Reader's Digest version. But the longer version goes, I'm the youngest of three girls. I grew up in Dunwoody, so not too far from where I am now. I'm very close with my mom and my sisters. I wasn't very close with my dad. I loved my dad, but in my mind, he always demanded perfection, and anything less than that was not good enough. I have come to realize that that's probably just how I interpreted that and how I saw that. That might not necessarily be facts. It's just more of how I felt. So I was always trying to be perfect. And, you know, I can recall, you know, if I got straight A's, he would say something like, well, that's great. Now, if you could only do that in this area of your life, you know, so I just never felt like I was living up to anything. He wasn't abusive. He didn't, you know, hit us or anything like that. I mean, you know, spank us when we were little, but he would threaten to. I heard a lot of, I'll hit you so hard you won't sit down for a week, or I'll hit you so hard your head will spin. And I believed him. So I was pretty terrified of him. So that was hard to live up to, and not feeling comfortable in your own skin and not feeling like you were ever perfect, even though you tried really hard, was just difficult for me to manage. So when I was 12 years old, that was in 1982, so I'll save you the math, I just turned 50. Anyway, in 1982, I was in a sledding accident because, you know, we don't know how to deal with snow here in the South. But it was pretty bad, and the first doctors said they were going to have to amputate my foot. I was in the hospital for a very long time. Luckily, that did not happen, but I was in the hospital for a long time, had like a year or so recovery. And so that was the first time I had any mind-altering substances when they gave me pain medication. Quickly, I do respect the rooms of AA, and I will try not to talk too much about the outside substances, but they are, you know, part of my story. But alcohol is the only thing that was ever continuous in my story. So anyway, when I was 12, I had pain medicine, and I remember that nurse who gave me, I remember her name, you know, and I was only 12. So that probably should have been a good sign that I was going to have a problem. Her name was Marva, just in case anyone wants to know. She was great. Then when I was 14 is really kind of when things changed for me. That was when I went to school. It was kindergarten through 7th grade was elementary, and 8th grade through 12th grade was high school. So that was pretty challenging, too. We didn't have middle school or junior high. So in 8th grade, you know, I had just turned 14, and I'm going to school with, you know, 18, 19-year-olds. That's a big difference at that age. So it was pretty hard to fit in. So I had a friend, her name was Kathy, and in 8th grade, she committed suicide. And she was my very, you know, she was a good friend of mine, and it was really hard. But it was kind of like I saw she found a way out, you know? And so eventually I did try to commit suicide. I didn't necessarily want to die. I just didn't want my life. I didn't want to live my life as it was. I just didn't feel comfortable. That summer when I was 14, I went to yearbook camp, and that was the first time I had alcohol. I remember what I was wearing. I remember everyone that was in the room. I remember their names. I remember it so well, which now that I'm in the rooms, I've come to find out that probably is another good sign that I was going to have a problem. Anyway, when I had when I drank, I didn't like the taste of it. And to be honest, I never really liked the taste of alcohol ever. I could tolerate beer, but it wasn't like I liked it. I 100% drank for the effects that it produced. And I drank it only for that. It was purposeful, and I had a mission every time, and I was very successful at it. Anyway, that was the first time that I had that same feeling that I did when I was in the hospital. I could exhale. I could relax. I wasn't so anxious. I didn't feel like I was coming out of my skin. And that kind of started my journey. In high school, I drank on the weekends. We all did. You know, I was probably more of a heavy drinker than some of the other kids, but, you know, I didn't necessarily feel like I stood out. I graduated and I ended up going to college. I went to Auburn, and getting out, I felt like, you know, I was now out from underneath my parents. I had that freedom that I so wanted. I didn't feel like I had to be perfect all the time, and I could drink whenever I wanted to, and I did. So after about 2.5 years, my grades reflected that, and I was invited to leave Auburn. So that didn't last too long, and I do regret that, or I wish that I would have graduated, but I didn't. So I came home, and after a couple months, I was dating my soon-to-be husband. We were high school sweethearts. We went to college together, and we moved to California. We decided to pack everything up and go. Moved across from Georgia to California, hated it, and eventually came back. Shortly after that, we got married. So we were married for 10 years before we had our first child. I do have 3 kids now. And when I was pregnant, I got migraines really bad. And so I went to the doctor for that, and they did give me prescriptions to help with the migraines. I didn't take them at first because I was afraid to do that while I was pregnant. But once I had my kids, I was all in. And eventually, I remember telling my doctor, I feel like I'm becoming one of those housewives that's hooked on medication and doesn't know how to get off of it. And actually, I had to write that in a note because I was too embarrassed to say it. So he sent me on to a neurologist. And at that point, now I had 2 doctors that were writing me prescriptions, and that's what I did. So, I went with that, and nothing washed that down better than alcohol. And that lasted for a long time. So my marriage did not last. I was married for 20 years, and out of respect for my kids, I don't really share a whole lot about why my marriage didn't last, but I can tell you that alcohol didn't help at all. And really, that's about the most important part of it, is that alcohol did not help my marriage. So after 20 years, I asked for a divorce. I really kind of felt like once I got rid of him that my problems were going to be gone, and everything would have been solved. And what it did is it just sped my downfall even faster. You know, I could drink when and how I wanted to, and it really only took about 2-3 years for me to hit bottom after that. Towards the very end, I was waking up at, like, I would set my alarm for 6 o'clock in the morning so I could get up and take a couple shots and throw up outside before my kids woke up so that I could get them on the bus. I couldn't even function without it, and I never really thought that I would ever be that type of person. So what happened was a good friend of mine, well, let's see, in my neighborhood that I lived in at the time, we were a party neighborhood. You know, we were known for partying. And there was a 4th of July party that we had every year in the neighborhood. The kids looked forward to it. Everyone loved going. And that year, I was not invited because no one wanted to be around me anymore. You really never knew what you were going to get with me. And I was crushed. And I was embarrassed. And I had a lot of shame and guilt. And I had to explain to my kids, you know, why I thought we weren't invited. And that was humiliating. And a few days after that, my very good friend confronted me and said she thought I had a drinking problem. She had mentioned it to my mom prior to that, but I was able to, you know, lie my way out of that because, you know, my family didn't want to see that I was an alcoholic and I didn't want to be an alcoholic, so it was a great combination. So anyway, like I said, she confronted me, and for some reason, you know, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, she said, I think you have a problem and we need to get you some help. And I said, out of nowhere, yes, I need help. And that was it. She brought me home, and I packed a bag, and I went to Ridgeview. I went to rehab. Just to, you know, give you some idea of where I was when I packed that bag, I had the shorts on that I was wearing. You know, it's July, and so I had shorts on, and I packed a bathing suit and like maybe a t-shirt. Like, I didn't pack any other shorts. I didn't pack any other clothes. I mean, I just didn't know what I was doing. I was just so lost. Like, I was going to camp or something. Who needs a bathing suit at rehab? But apparently I thought I did. I wasn't going to Passages by any means. So, anyway, just kind of give you an idea of where I was. So, you know, in rehab, I remember when they closed that door behind me, it was like the loudest echo ever. I remember looking at myself in the mirror thinking, how did I get here? You know, I'm better than this. I have more willpower than this. How did this happen to me? And I was just so disgusted with myself. But I found hope in there. I found hope. I found other people that thought like me and felt like me. And as embarrassed and humiliated as I felt and desperate as I was, I didn't feel alone for the first time in a really long time. So I went through it. I was there for 30 days. I got out and I immediately got a sponsor. And I started, you know, working the steps. I didn't ever want to admit that I was an alcoholic. I knew my life was unmanageable, but I just didn't want to be an alcoholic. And saying, you know, hi, I'm Molly and I'm an alcoholic was the hardest thing for me to ever say. That was, I feel like, the lowest in my, active alcoholism. And it was that gift of desperation. I'd never felt so desperate. And, you know, so all I felt embarrassed and shameful and humiliated. And at the same time, it was such a relief. It's such a strange feeling to have all of that happen all at once just by saying the words out loud, I'm an alcoholic, you know. So anyway, I worked the steps and I was going to meetings. So about a year and a half in, my ex-husband now lived down the street, and he had been saying to me for, a couple weeks how he was having some procedures done, and he was in a lot of pain, and he was having to take pain medicine, and blah, blah, blah. He just kept mentioning that, you know, and so it was in the back of my head. So I was on my way to Serenity House, and he was out of town, and I passed by his house, and I thought, I know he has pain medicine. I'm going to stop in there and get some. Just for safekeeping, like I ever would have saved it for safekeeping. I mean, you know, still delusional, like thinking I'm just going to file that away somewhere for a rainy day or in case of emergency. But that's not how I ever drank or, you know, took anything. So anyway, I put it in my pocket, took some and put them in my pocket. And I went to the meeting, and thank God I went to the meeting. I didn't hear anything at that meeting, and right before it ended, I remember saying, hey, I'm Molly. I haven't heard anything anyone has said. You're all getting on my nerves. You sound like the Charlie Brown teachers. All I heard this whole meeting was wah, 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 wah. You know, it was awful. It was awful. And thank God some of the women there pulled me aside and were like, so what's going on? So I told them what I did, and they said, you have some choices to make. So what I said was, and what I did was I said, I'm going to go put him back. So on my way back from the meeting, I went back to his house and I put them back. Unfortunately, about a week later, I got a call from the Gwinnett County Police, and my ex-husband had set up video recordings in his house, and he had me on video taking the medicine, and he had me arrested. So I was 18 months sober, and I had to go to jail. I'd never been to jail. I'd never had any legal consequences, and I had to go turn myself in for theft by taking, I believe is what they called it. It turns out that I stole Tylenol in the end, but it didn't matter. In my head, I thought it was something, you know, stronger than that, and I took it, and he didn't force me to do it. It was my fault. I did it. No one made me do that but me. So anyway, so then I had to hire attorneys. I had an emergency hearing. I thought I was going to lose my kids. I thought I was going to lose my job. And leading up to that court date, you know, I remember praying to God to, you know, please don't take my kids, which kind of turned into bargaining, like, I'll do anything. Please don't let me lose my kids. You know, it's begging, you know, don't leave me alone. I won't make it. But what that did is it turned into surrender. Sorry. This part always gets me, and I don't know why. When I was sitting in the courtroom right before the judge came back in to give his verdict, I remember praying, dear God, please help me accept whatever this outcome is. I didn't say, don't take my kids, don't leave me alone. I said, please help me accept whatever this is. And that was my first time I ever surrendered. And it still gets me, you know, to this day. Luckily, I got to keep my kids. And I'm sure it's not how my ex-husband wanted it to go. But in all honesty, he saved my life by doing that. Because had I gotten away with it, I would have done it again. So really, I owe him a lot for doing that. Prior to that, you know, I didn't know how to let go. You know, that surrender taught me how to let go. Because I would hear in the rooms, let go, let God. And I'd be like, well, that's really easy to say, but how do you do that? I don't know how to do that. And I had a girl explain it to me one time, and I share this a lot, but only because it was just so profound for me for some reason. I'm such a visual person. She said, it's kind of like water skiing. You know, when they teach you how to water ski, they're like, you know, bend your knees, get the skis out of the water, hold on to the rope, you know, the boat eventually is going to pull you up. And that's true, and that's what happens. What I never heard or never understood was, when you fall, you have to let go of the rope. That's the first thing you have to do is let go of that rope. And I wouldn't do that. I would hold on to that rope. And so now I'm being pulled behind the boat. Water's rushing in my face. I'm drowning on top of, you know, everything else. And all I'm trying to do is hold on to save my life. And if I would have let go of the rope, I had a life vest on. I had people in the boat. You know, I kind of think of it as my sponsor, my network of women. And they're all yelling, we're going to come back and get you. You're going to be okay. Let go of the rope, you know. But I can't hear them because all the water's rushing by me. So, anytime that I am stuck on something and it's all consuming to me, I try to visualize that, physically letting go of the rope. And to me, that's giving it up to God. And that has been, you know, life-changing for me. Shortly after all that happened, I lost my first sponsor, I kind of felt like I was at an emotional bottom at that point. You know, here I was, like, I thought I was doing so great, and now I'm almost off my kids, my job, my sponsor, you know, everything. But I was able to, you know, I found my now new current sponsor, and what we did is we worked the steps as they're outlined in the book, and I hadn't done that the first time around, and that was crucial to me. I needed to have someone take me through them as they are outlined in the book. And as a result of working those steps, you know, I had a spiritual experience. Mine was, my spiritual experience, I feel like, are more of the educational variety that they talk about in the big book. I haven't ever had that, the bush and the big white light. You know, I kind of think of it more as God kind of opened the gate to hell. I just had to take that first step and get out. And that's kind of how my spiritual experiences started. And you guys helped me define who my higher power was, you know? So working the steps, you know, I got some relief from steps 4 and 5, you know, not to say that I didn't, but my biggest relief came from step 9. You know, that kind of taught me that amends doesn't necessarily mean reconciliation. It just means that I don't have to look over my shoulder anymore. I'm not constantly worried about, am I going to see this person? And is this going to be, am I going to have to carry this for the rest of my life? And, you know, there's a couple of amends that I haven't had the opportunity to make yet, but I'm willing to if and when they ever present themselves. And that, that to me is certainly an example of a spiritual experience. You know, you guys taught me that the difference between kind of shame and guilt, you know, because they were so intertwined when I first came in, and you taught me that, shame is saying I'm bad, I'm a bad person, and guilt is I did something bad, you know? So I was able to separate that and realize that I'm not a bad person. I've done some bad things, you know, but I can make amends. I can make a living amends and try to do better, you know? So I guess that kind of brings me to what it's like now. I really do have like a freedom and a happiness that I never thought that I would have. I'm living a life that I never thought I would be worthy of. It's given me so much more than I could have ever dreamed. You know, if I would have made a list when I walked in of everything that I wanted out of AA, I would have sold myself short. I would have never gotten, you know, I just couldn't imagine all the things that has been given to me today. I have a new set of tools that I can use instead of alcohol. And, I have, you know, I don't have that shame. I get a better person today. You know, now today I can be a good daughter and a good sister and a good mother and a good friend. All the things I always wanted to be, and I would always try to, rationalize or justify how I wasn't quite there yet. You know, I always wanted to be that great friend, and, you know, just because I couldn't show up for you or I'm not always there for you, it's only because this and this, you know, I'd rationalize and justify why I wasn't there yet. Today I get to be that person, you know, for the most part, my actions and words align. And that's a great feeling, you know, to be able to live that way. Have to make excuses. I don't have to rationalize or justify my behavior. I'm not perfect by any means. Although that's, you know, what I strive for when I was little, I'm not perfect. And today I am 100% okay with that. It's a relief not to have to strive for perfection. You know, I try to be the best person that I can be, and, I fall short a lot, but, you know, I have a sponsor, I have a higher power, and I have a network of women and tools that I can use to do better. You know, kind of today, an example of that is my, ex-mother-in-law. She passed away about a year ago or a little over a year ago. She didn't really care for me would be a little bit of an understatement. But she was always very good to my kids, and my kids loved her very much, and I respect that. So when she was sick and she was dying in the hospital, I was able to bring my kids to her. I was able to let them have a safe place to grieve. And at the very end, I mean, hours before she passed away, I was actually standing over her with holding my kids' hands and praying over this woman who hated me, you know? And the old me wouldn't have wanted anything to do with her. I would have said, she was terrible to me. Why am I going to go and be with her on her deathbed? But this program allows me to be that person today and to be that kind of mom for my kids. That's what they needed. They needed a safe place to be sad and to grieve. And, you know, there's just no other way to thank AA, you know, for giving me that kind of life. It just, you know, allows me to be who I always wanted to be, and I never thought that I could. I get to be there for my friends and my family, and I get to show up. You know, there's no greater feeling than, you know, if a friend has an event or their kids have an event or my kids have an event, I'm there. I am present, and I'm watching, and I'm part of it, and that's my living amends to my kids. And I'm constantly trying to take mental pictures along the way, like, remember this. Look how happy they are. Look how proud they are. And I get to see that and witness it. It's so cool. And I would have missed it before. Alcohol was robbing me of that, you know, and it was robbing my kids of that. So today, I don't regret the past. And, you know, for the most part, I stopped that future time travel and the future worries, you know. I was always really good about that, too. I never could stay where I was. And today I can stay in the moment. Not always. I do take an occasional road trip to the future, but I heard a speaker say one time, the only thing you can bring back from the future is fear. And that's so true. That's all I ever bring back from the future is fear. So why go there, you know? Just stay right where I am. I am okay right where I am. I'm alive. My feet are planted. My kids are good. I'm good. It's going to be fine. You know, I don't need to project all the terrible things that could possibly happen. You know, I basically have learned to insert God in the beginning of that terrible, vicious cycle that I never could before. I also get to pass along this message to other women, and that to me is the greatest gift I think I've ever been given. I get to pray for those who are still sick and suffering inside and outside of the rooms, and I 100% with my entire being believe that you guys prayed me into these rooms before I came in. At the end of meetings, when we hold hands and say, let's have a moment of silence for those who are still sick and suffering, that was me. I was out there, and I was sick, and I was suffering. And you guys prayed me in the rooms, and I believe that. And, you know, I don't know how to thank you for that other than praying for the other girl that's out there, because she's out there, and, you know, she needs us as much as I needed you guys. So today I get to pray for her. And when she walks in the room or she pops up on Zoom, I get to be there and tell her it's going to be okay. You know, I have experience in stopping that terrible cycle, and we're going to love you just like everyone loved me before I got here. And that's how I get to say thank you. You know, I get to witness miracles. So it's a win-win, man. How do you not love that? So it blows my mind that I still get to do that. And I hope, you know, just to continue to be an example to everyone else and to love the people when they come in these rooms. And I don't know how they're doing it on Zoom. That blows my mind, too. But it's not for me to understand, you know. It's for me to be here. And when their hand reaches out, you know, I want my hand to be there in return. So, that's pretty much what it's like today. I think that's all I've got. So thanks, everybody, for letting me share.
Woo, Molly!
Thank you, Molly. Thank you.
Thank you, Molly.
Thank you, Molly.
Pass the message. Yeah. Brought you network. Both men and women got a lot out of it tonight. So you've done great work with the ladies. Julia, do you have a comment?
I do. I too went to Ridgeview, and I had no idea what I was getting into. I actually thought I was going to sort of a spa. I didn't realize it was actually they were going to help me. You know? So yeah. I had my perfume, and I had all my stuff, and they took all that away from me too. And I had the same chilling feeling when I heard that door close behind me. So I felt that viscerally, and I love the skiing analogy. Wow, I've definitely had the water up my nose from skiing with the, so I know that. I'm going to remember that. And I will promise you, if I use it, I will attribute it. I'm kind of known for taking things that people say. But I tend to give you credit. So I love that. I'll take that.
Everything I've learned, I'm regurgitating from other people.
Exactly. Nothing is made up. Very little is actually made up. All right. Well, thank you for being here. It was a fabulous story.
Thank you, Julie.
Got me running round in circles, grin upside down. Falling off the edge, it don't sound like fun. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone. Ought to learn a lesson, breaking all the rules. Try a listening session, the guilty luxury fools. Sleep away the day, hiding from the sun. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone. We gotta stop fighting.